Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber. This week's Red Inca is a story about the original English lady cricketers, the first professional women players from the 1800s. And to talk about it, we have someone who has written a book on the entire subject.
Yeah, I am Giles Wilcock, and I have written a book called Forgotten Pioneers, the story of the original English lady cricketers. I've also got a cricket history blog called Old Ebo.
We talk about the man who was behind it, the weird ad, how this story lives almost entirely in newspaper archives, that George Lohman was a bowling coach, that there was a musical side to the whole thing, the reaction to the press, what W.G. Grace said, and also we talk about soap and clowns. This is a story that I can't remember when I first found out about. This might have been when I was doing the history of men's test cricket, and I came across this story, and it blew my mind that before 1900, there was a professional women's league. And, you know, there's always, you probably find in my work or, you know, Abhishek's work or Arun's work, you know, a lot of the sort of more internet level historians, we all kind of talk about it, but there isn't much there. And I remember Abhishek saying to me when we're writing a book about that, you know, the history of teams when they play England for the first time, and we have a chapter on the women's team in it. And Abhishek was like, "Oh, you know, we should just get Giles's book." And I was like, "What? There's a whole book on this." When did you first hear about it, and what piqued your interest? You know, what was it that got you into this topic?
I'd written something for the Night Watchman magazine. I think it was in 2020, and when I was looking through the issue that I had my article in, there was an article by, I think it was Isabel Duncan, and she just mentioned in passing this thing called the original English lady cricketers, and I thought, that's a bit strange. And it mentioned about how the managers had run off with the money, and I thought, that sounds quite interesting. And I just started digging into that then. I wrote something for my blog, but there was so much more to it, and I just kept digging after that, and it eventually came out into this book. And I think the most interesting thing was the fact that, like you say, the fact that there was professional women's cricket in 1890. Mm. It's insane when you think how long it then took for women's professional cricket to come back.
Yeah, just the 100-odd-year gap in the middle. Tell me about the man. He's an interesting character, obviously not particularly a women's cricket fan or anything else. He's an entrepreneur, really, and not even, you know, English.
Well, he's a mysterious chap. He was called Edward Mitchell, and he's quite hard to track down because he seems to have done several jobs. But from what I've been able to work out, him and his brother were, like you say, entrepreneurs, and they were just looking for as many ways as they could to make money. Shortly before the women's cricket team came out, he'd been a manager for an Australian, I don't know what you'd call them. They were called Snell's Australian Giants. And it was basically a family that had outsized children that were going around the country exhibiting them, very Victorian. And yeah. He'd been
like
the manager
an old freak
then.
Show type of thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a few other things going on. And then just suddenly he becomes associated with this women's cricket team. It's not, he claimed it was his idea. But the other person involved in it was Walter Bosanquet, who was the exact relationship. I think he's the first cousin once removed of Bernard Bosanquet, the googly inventor.
Yeah.
And between them, they seem to have come up with this idea of the women's cricket team. But it went through a few different permutations. First, it was going to be just an athletics team. And then it became just a various sports team, and then it became almost like a circus team before it settled down on the idea of a cricket team. But the Edward Mitchell himself, he then spun this very elaborate backstory for himself where he was French, but he'd been brought up in America. He wasn't French at all. He was born in London and his family from Cornwall. But yeah, he just spun. He was very good at self-publicity. And the slightly mysterious thing about him, which I still can't explain, is that the name he used in his background was almost stolen from another man who was a manager in a railway company who was actually, he was actually French, and he was called Edward Mitchell. But there was no connection between the two. And why he chose this particular person to steal his identity, I have no idea. There's nothing to suggest what was going on. It's very, very mysterious.
And the first time this sort of enters the public consciousness is when he puts up an ad. And it's quite clear from the ad that he's not looking for the greatest 22 cricketers in England. He's looking for younger women of a certain sexiness. He doesn't quite put it that way, but he's clearly looking for, you know, women who look attractive, who will look good on a cricket field rather than athletic women who are already good at cricket.
Yeah. And the main ad was the one, I think the main focus for that was you're looking for tennis players. But that was when it was all very fluid and I don't think he knew what he wanted back then. And that's the one that it attracted quite a lot of attention. I think the original ad was in the Daily Telegraph. And then it kind of got picked up as one of those novelty stories and all the other newspapers copied it. And suddenly everyone was talking about this women's cricket team. But then at the same time as he was doing that, he also had put in adverts in other newspapers, especially theatrical newspapers, looking for, I think it was things, he was looking for a professional cyclist. He was looking for theatre costumes, leotards, tights, somebody that was experienced with a trapeze. So yeah, he was covering all his bases pretty much.
Your book is based on newspaper archives. And one of the reasons you could do that is, even though it's not a particularly well-known story today, it was clearly at the time talked about quite a lot.
It was massive. And there were so many newspaper stories. Every newspaper covered it. And there was quite a lot of national attention. The theatrical newspapers covered it a lot because there was that always that link with theatre. And a few, Sporting Life covered it a lot. They were very interested in it. And then every local newspaper where they went to visit around the country, they covered it as well. The only people that didn't really touch it were the more respectable ones. So I think the Times didn't mention it at all in its first season. The Telegraph mentioned it once. And then the big cricket publication at the time was Cricket, a weekly record of the game. That was the really big cricket publication then. That didn't mention them at all, apart from one very vague mention at the end of the season. They just didn't want to touch it. But the rest of the press, they loved it. Couldn't get enough of it.
From a cricket perspective, the cricket wasn't of a great standard because that wasn't why any of these women were recruited in the first place. But from a spectacle standpoint, it clearly worked because lots of people went to watch this and it made money.
Yeah, a huge number of people went to watch it. You have to be a little bit careful with the attendance numbers because a lot of them were guesses. But if they're saying there's 10,000 people watching, it's obviously going to be quite full at the ground. But yeah, there was a huge number of people went, as far as we can tell. Again, you have to kind of work it out, but it made a big profit. In terms of how good the cricket was, it's hard to say. There were about, I think, there were usually about 22 to 24 players that were kind of in the squads, not the right word, but that kind of thing.
The group, yeah.
And of those, there were about eight that, from what it looks like, they were very decent cricketers. But the rest, like I said, they were picked for other abilities, particularly for what they could bring to the theatrical side, because after most of the games, they went to local theatres and music halls, they put on a show. And so you had people that were gymnasts, you did have a professional cyclist, you had people that could put on dancing displays and become the trapeze. But there were about eight who were pretty good cricketers. One in particular, she was called, well, her real name was Violet Lyon, but she called herself Violet Westbrook. She was incredibly good. I mean, the opposition might not have been great, but she just towered above everybody else. And from what evidence that survives, she was she'd always played. She was a bit of a fanatic and she was really into her cricket. But no, the rest were making up the numbers and adding a bit of glamour, I think, in a few cases.
So in those days, there's some of the other cricket matches that are played around the world, especially in places like Australia, where really good women's teams would play men's teams. But this is more about the women playing women as an overall spectacle, isn't it? It wasn't about trying to show how good they were or take down men there was a weird one in Australia where you had to be so old or so overweight in order to play. It wasn't anything like that. It wasn't that kind of Victorian spectacle. It was more like you were watching a performance of cricket of women. And that was the idea from the business plan.
It was just a chance to come and watch these women in costumes that, as by Victorian standards, the skirts were fairly short. They were just below the knee, which was slightly above respectable. But it was just come and watch women playing cricket. There was a certain element of trying to show that women could play, but not in terms of competing with men. Because what the standard kind of women's cricket before that was, you would play a women's team against a men's team, but the men would have to bat with the wrong hand and bowl with the wrong hand. And it was a bit of a joke. And actually, Walter Bosanquet, who financed all this, he actually did say at one point that he didn't want it to be that sort of game. He thought it was a bit of a travesty of cricket. But then the other side to this was there was a bit of an industry of cricket as entertainment that was a thing back then, and it did very much fit into that. There had been theatrical teams before where they would go around the towns. There was a very strange phenomenon called clown cricket, where you had teams of clowns, literal clowns, playing. But in amongst that, you had some quite good cricketers. You actually had some people that went to play test cricket in these clown cricket teams. So there was some seriousness, but then when they were fielding, they were falling over and there were custard pies and bats with holes in. So there was that mix, but it was supposed to be not just sport, it was entertainment as well.
Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are a new player in the game trying to educate fans on what is really happening in cricket. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts and articles on what is happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket 8 is your place for cricket intelligence. Yeah, that thing's really common. There's also games that were played against actors by real cricketers where they used things like brooms and things, wasn't there? It seems silly to us now, but the combination of those two things, the oval was used a lot for these sort of random cricket games back in that time. Just to go back to the after-match musical drama society events that they were putting on, if you think about it, it's quite clever, other than the fact that poor women would be exhausted after playing cricket all day, then going, I have to go and put on another show. But they were really maximizing the amount of time in each town and probably going to two slightly different audiences as well, right?
Yeah, it was very much, it came as a package, but it was definitely, one was aimed, certainly as the idea developed, it was aimed at the sporting audience, but then in the evening it was aimed at the music hall audience. And I think part of the idea was you could see these women playing cricket in the day and then you could watch them fencing at night or singing or playing the banjo or it's hard to be sure, but quite a few of the players seem to have had some sort of background in theatre and performance. Mm-hmm. And quite what they thought when they ended up playing cricket for 5 months, I don't know. But they were, some of them were quite good from what it seems. But yeah, it was very much, I think when Edward Mitchell came up with the idea, he wanted to tap into the popularity of music hall. And I think he was looking for a gimmick, a way in, because it was such a competitive market. And this idea of, we can make these famous cricketers, now let's get them to put on a show in the evening. And some people will come to both, some people will just come to the theatre. It was quite a clever idea for the time, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting. The reaction of the press, so... as you said before, it was talked about a lot, especially more in the tabloid side of things. How did they handle it, the press? Because it's not exactly, it's not something that, you know, women playing sport wasn't really all that well handled, let alone at a professional level with men going to watch and everything else.
Yeah, you kind of got two sides of complaint. You got the whole idea of women shouldn't be playing sport. How dare they? It's going to do this. It's going to do that. But then you got the other side was women should just be playing in country houses. We shouldn't be paying to watch women play cricket.
Yeah.
The reaction... It was a bit strange because some of the journalists absolutely loved it. They thought it was amazing. They thought that the standard was fantastic. Then there were other people who thought, no, 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 this is a travesty. What are you doing to the game of cricket? No, no, no. And it was very extreme. And I think what you would get is that the journalists that went to the matches, they knew before they went what they were going to say. And so you'd get two journalists going to the exact same game. One of them would say, oh, the standard was brilliant, the batting was good, the fielding was fantastic. Then the same match, another journalist would say, the batting was awful, the fielding was terrible, they can't throw. Some of the press reaction was quite hostile. One in particular, St. James's Gazette, was really quite insulting. And some of the writing there was really, really misogynistic. It was literally, women should just be learning how to cook. Why are they out here playing cricket? Somebody else wrote something about how it was humiliating seeing these women playing on the field, but not for them, for their husbands and for their brothers and their fathers. And what would their future husbands think if they could see that? Then you got the other reaction, which was, why are they even playing cricket? Let's just look at them, look at how pretty they are, and look at their costumes, and people would pay just to watch that. And you got some very prudish reactions, you got some very encouraging reactions where it was, no, this is a really good idea, they should go forward with it. So it was a very mixed bag. And I think, generalizing, at the start of the first season in 1890, it was kind of very sceptical. It was, oh, this isn't going to be very good. The standard's going to be poor. But over the course of that first season, almost everybody that wrote about it came to say, no, actually, this is really good. This has been a real success. They're actually really good cricketers. And by the end of the season, they were quite accepted. It had gone from being a little bit seedy, a little bit what's all this about, to being quite respected.
There's a couple of famous cricketers that are kind of involved in different ways. So obviously George Lohmann was involved as a coach. Whether he coached or whether they just put his name on it, or maybe he came down to one training session, I don't know. Whereas W.G. Grace, and you know, you're talking about two of the most famous cricketers of that period. W.D. Grace wasn't particularly on side of it. What do you know about the Lohmann story to begin with?
I think what happened was his brother, Stuart, was involved quite a bit with the coaching, I think. And I think, like you say, I think George Lohmann came to maybe one or two of the sessions and it was, ooh, let's get his name down. And he featured in all the advertising. You see these cricketers being coached by George Lohmann. The other coaches, there were a few coaches. I think the biggest name would have been George Hearn of Kent. But Lohmann was the kind of the big famous name that they all played on. Later on, there were a few others that were sort of associated. But again, I think it was more a case of let's attach somebody's name to it rather than they were particularly deeply involved. W.G. Grace is quite interesting because he had some very strong views on women's cricket. He thought it was okay for girls to play at school. But that once they left school, they had to stop immediately because it was defeminizing, which was quite a common idea among men at the time, that it was going to be defeminizing.
Because you can't defeminize a girl when she's 15, but when she's 18, you can certainly defeminize it. I'm pretty sure that's how science works.
Yeah. And he, to give him a little bit of understanding. The only time that he really spoke about him at length was in his reminiscences that he wrote in 1899. And at the time that he said that it was terrible, and they should, I think his exact quote was, they had their day and ceased to be, and basically it was all a disaster. He was writing just after his daughter had died, really young, and she'd actually been quite a good cricketer. He'd stopped her playing once she left school, but you can just imagine that if he's having to write about something, if his ghostwriter said to him, let's talk about the women's cricket team, and he's still in mourning. So I don't think he was ever a fan, but I think he maybe came across a little bit harsher.
He probably wouldn't have seen it, right? Like, I'd be surprised if he went to any games.
No, there's nothing to suggest that. There were a few first-class cricketers that did go to games. Mm. So, for example, the Australian team that was over in 1890, they went to at least one game. And if I remember rightly, Jack Blackham actually donated a pair of wicket-keeping gloves to the two wicket-keepers in the team. Off the top of my head, I think it was 1890 rather than 1891, the Yorkshire team went to at least one game and sat through it. I can't remember, but certainly those two teams did go along. So there was some support from the bigger names that was a bit more supportive than W.G. Grace, but I don't think he went anywhere near, no.
Jack Blackham also was forget-me-nots. I can't believe I said I forget the name and then remembered they were called the forget-me-nots, but the Australian cricket team from Warrnambool, he was a big fan of their wicketkeeper as well. So he was a very interesting early ally of women's cricket, considering everything. So and again, always talking about wicketkeeping. So maybe he didn't care about gender, just wicketkeeping, which is also a very good thing. The other interesting thing, and I can't remember, there was something I was writing and I started working this out, and this is before I saw your book, but very soon after, and this happens a lot, there's a lot of these private cricket teams that get successful. As you said, the clown leagues, suddenly there's clown leagues everywhere. Yeah. You know, or clown teams, I should say, rather than clown leagues. You have the, All English 11 team that starts to travel around England, and then there's four other versions of that that come off the back of that. The exact same thing happens here. You have this original, the original women's ladies cricketers, and then you have about four other knockoff and spin-offs that come off the back of that. If nothing else, that shows you how successful it was in that first year, that people were already, ripping it off.
I think what it was is that people saw the amount of money that must have been made, they saw the attendances, and it was, oh, how can we cash in? My favourite cash-in team was a soap company, because after the first season had gone quite well, adverts started appearing for a team called Arthur's Ideal Lady Cricketers, which was sponsored by a soap company called the name of the company was Arthur's Ideal Soap. And through 1891, they were touring up, copying the format, basically, of playing in the day and then theatre in the evening. But there were some very strange promotions. So, for example, at the ground while they were playing, there was this soap on sale, and there were special offers. It was something like, if you can bring 12 wrappers of Arthur's soap, you get free admission. So there were some very strange things, and that went down really badly. And people were even comparing. It was almost like that made the original English lady cricketers better, because at least they weren't selling soap. So it got quite silly. And then the soap team kind of just disappeared, and there were legal action against the managers, and it was all very messy. And if I remember rightly as well, the soap team, Arthur's team, was associated with a newspaper as well. And the even were elements of clown cricket with people falling over and stuff. So it spawned a lot of imitators. There was probably at least one other team. There was one that tried to get off the ground, and it's not clear if it ever did, because they actually tried to steal a lot of the players from the original English lady cricketers. That doesn't seem to have got off the ground, but there was possibly at least one more team, possibly even two, but there's not really left any traces, so it's hard to say how many there were exactly.
So how does it go from a performance, a cricket game, a touring like the Harlem Globetrotters of women's cricket to not existing? You know, is it just that it was a novelty? Because there were so many novelty things back in you know, that era of England that sort of popped up and everyone got really excited about them for 6 months and then they disappeared. Was it like that? Was it mismanagement? Was there something else going on?
Good question, because it's the returned in 1891 and it started quite well, but there were a lot of factors. So for example, the weather was terrible. They'd had really good weather in 1890, so they got big crowds, but 1891 was very wet. There was quite a lot of illness going around as well, so they couldn't always put up full team. They had to miss a few of the games that had been arranged. I think there was certainly an element of novelty wearing off, but there were still games that got attendances in the thousands. Probably the two biggest issues were, first of all, that some of the kind of biggest players from the first season didn't play in the second season. They'd not become famous, they weren't household names, but people were aware of them and suddenly they'd stopped playing. And then the money seems to have run out, but it's hard to say exactly what happened. And it then got very messy. So the original company that was running it folded. Somebody else took over, but everybody was very careful not to say who it was. So you don't know what's going on. There's something a bit strange. It could have been the original people that didn't want people to know. And then the money seems to have run out again, but at a time when the attendances were quite good. And eventually it just fizzled out. The team just stopped appearing. But then a few months later, a story appeared in a newspaper, The Star, which accused the managers of the team of effectively running off with all the gate receipts. And that culminated in a court case where somebody was found liable for unpaid wages. But again, it all went very quiet on this idea of fraud, and it was almost like it was being hushed up. There's some behind-the-scenes deal going on. It's all very mysterious, but it's a combination of things and quite probably a little bit of fraud at the end didn't help matters very much.
I mean, it rarely does.
No.
When you get to that point, what happens afterwards? You know, you said some of these women were well known. Obviously, by this point, you know, Edward Michelle or whoever he was, had built a reputation. He had a successful business. What happens to all these people? Do some of them go on to lead extraordinary lives? Do we even know who they all are? I mean, it sounds like we don't even fully know everything about him.
No, there's... Once it all collapsed, the final kind of dregs of it died out in 1892. There's a few of the women that we can trace. There's a few we don't even know the names because they played under false names or they had really common names and it's just impossible to trace them. Of those that we can trace, most of them seem to have gone back to a very ordinary life. Edward Mitchell went back to his old job, probably working for Walter Bosanquet, but it's hard to be sure. But he went back to, I think he ended up being a travelling salesman. The only ones that we know a little bit more about of the team, there was one of the team captains who went by the name of Daisy Stanley. That wasn't a real name, but that's what she went by. And she tried to carry on. She actually left the team early and tried to set up her own team. We don't know how successful she was. And then a couple of years later, she tried to set up an athletics team, like an athletics exhibition team going around the country. But then she seems to have given up and she got married and went for the quiet life. The only one who carried on doing slightly extraordinary things was a player who went by the name of Marie Beckenham. And she wasn't much of a cricketer, to be honest. But after she'd finished, she went into theatre, not as an actress, as a manager. And she had a career in theatrical management for the best part of 50 years. And she was actually really well-known and really well-respected. She had, when she died in, I think it was 1957, she had an obituary on the stage. She was that big a name. And she was interviewed in newspapers. So she kind of carried on. And ironically, her real name was Mary Willett. And she called herself Marie Beckenham to play cricket. But she kept that name for the rest of her life. And so she was always known when she was working in theatre as Marie Beckenham. And she was the only one of the players who was interviewed in later years. She did an interview in 1956 and she kind of talked about it a little bit. And she donated her cricket costume to the MCC, and it's actually in the Lord's Museum still to this day.
I suppose my last question is, why do you think it didn't happen again? I think class plays a part a little bit, because the professionalism, having an all-professional cricket team in the late 1800s actually happened quite a bit, right? Mm. By the 1900s, men's cricket doesn't have all-professional teams all that often, and they disappear. So from, I don't know, 1830 to 1895, there's quite a few professional men's cricket teams, and then they disappear. So I'd assume class and professionalism played a part. Also, women's cricket becomes really an elite sport. You know, the sorts of women who play are, you know, from landed gentry and the 1%, however you want to put it. But even within that, it feels like they, at the very least, there should have been some money to be made, so someone could have come up with it again. But it just never happens, and it just sort of disappears for until what, 2012, 2014, when the England women's team become the first professional players.
It's hard to say, because there was a few years after the cricket team collapsed, there was a very similar thing with a women's football team in, I've forgotten exactly, I think it was 1895. And that was very similar. It did well for a year and then it fizzled out. But it was almost as if the people had been burnt by the reaction to these teams in the end. Because once they'd stopped playing, it was very, the only coverage you got was, oh, when those women tried to play cricket, it didn't work, did it? And there were even comments, if when other things were happening, very disparaging comments about, remember those women cricketers, oh, it all failed, didn't it? So I think that kind of scared people off. And I think, as you say, there was just that change in cricket where professionalism had to be controlled, and if men professionals were having to be controlled, there was no chance for women professionals. But I think the other side to it was that, like you say, women's cricket became very elitist, and when it took off in the 1930s, it was entirely amateur and there was not even a hint to professionalism, and it was very much a case of, oh no, we don't want to be tainted with professionalism. And I think the whole kind of idea that you got in late Victorian England that you could basically try anything to see if it worked, that just went away. It was, no, we have to do it like this now. This is how it should be. And that almost, that pioneering idea of, ooh, what, let's try this. Can we do this? That faded away. And so it never got repeated.
Giles, thank you so much for coming on. The book is called Forgotten Pioneers, the story of the original English lady cricketers. And good luck with it all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.